Գունգտրեք SBS հայերենը. A few days ago, Adelaide-based writer John Cox was in Sydney to launch his novel Angel of Aleppo. John is back in Adelaide, and to get more details about his novel and his future writing plans, let's welcome John to our program. John, welcome to SBS Armenian.
Hi. Thank you for that warm welcome, and I'm happy to be here.
John, you just returned from Sydney. It's a long drive where you launched your novel. Could you give your impressions about the book launch and your meetings with members of Sydney's Armenian community?
Yeah, well, it was a very pleasant experience. It was great. I had worked for a while beforehand with Mrs. Nora Bastagian, who is the chair of the Hamaskayin Literary Society, one of the many committees of Hamaskayin in Sydney, and people on her committee. I sort of had a number of like Zoom meetings with them and all of that, and it was really good. They covered all the bases. So when Lilith and I arrived, you know, we had the Armenian Cultural Center was more or less set up. Everyone was ready. They went through all the protocols. There was a young dancer I had contacted and got to perform the Mush dance as a part of the presentation. And we had time to rehearse all of that, and it was great. So organizational was, you know, spot on. And they had His Eminence, the Archbishop Haygazoun Najarian, present. And Father Avagiz Badzoumian also representing, the spiritual side of the community, and some other, significant faces in the Armenian crowd there. So it was all good, and, we were very happy with the organisation.
John, so far you launched your book in Adelaide and Sydney. Any plans to launch the book in Melbourne or other cities?
Well, we haven't launched in Adelaide yet, but we are going to this week for the first. We've got three events. Yes, we are going to come to Melbourne. That's our plan. Nothing is sort of set up for that yet, but I'm sure that the Melbourne people, the counterparts to the Sydney people, will do a great job in setting it all up when the time comes. In the interim, we have a launch on this coming Thursday night, May 27, at the Burnside Town Hall. You know, tickets are still available for that. You know, in these COVID days, you've got to actually sort of lock in your presence. And, of course, they're capped. Although Burnside Town Hall is a big space, and I think that we can have over 100. So that'd be great if I get that many. Be sensational. And we also have one here in the town where I live, Mount Barker, in the Adelaide Hills. That's in the Mount Barker Library. That's our local one, so that will feature a lot of my local friends and associates and possibly some of my former students. I hope to see a few of them there because I'm a retired teacher and I was at Mount Barker High School for 10 years. A number of the former students are aware of it, and I'm hoping to see some of them. And then finally, we have one at Port Adelaide It's in a friend's bar in Port Adelaide. That'll be interesting. Won't be a big one, but a whole lot of people who live in the western suburbs will attend that one. And so, you know, I'm really going all out to get it out there and hoping to see the Sydney launch appear digitally fairly soon. You know, the recording of the Sydney launch is going to go up on Hamaskayin Literary Society Facebook page, along with the link to buy the book. Obviously, this is intended for Armenians further afield and overseas and all the rest, so that they can see my launch remotely at least and have an easy sort of path to click through to buy the book.
John, how the idea of the novel came to you? Were you thinking about it for a long time, or any particular event triggered it?
Well, yes. There's a lot of things I was thinking about. Firstly, it's my wife's story, you know, in many ways. My wife Lilith is Armenian born, Long story short, we met online in 2009. I went to Armenia to meet her in person. She came here, we got married, and in that period of time, I had already learned about the Armenian genocide, and I had, prior to knowing Lilith, I knew very little about Armenia. I knew a bit about Armenia, former Soviet Republic and that sort of thing. I might have heard the words Armenian genocide without really knowing a hell of a lot about it. But once I got to know Lilith, and once I'd been to Armenia, and once I'd studied Armenian history a little bit, you know, it came to me with a massive sledgehammer blow. My God, these people have suffered like few others have suffered. And it really sort of affected me profoundly, you know, in an emotional level and all the rest. When I got a good look at the grinding poverty I saw in parts of the Yerevan, and I realized when I was there for the first time, and again the second time, before the Velvet Revolution, I realized what a corrupt government there was, and how, you know, like it was a handful of very wealthy, and then everyone else was poor to very poor. You know, and they've suffered ever since the genocide. I thought, I was appalled at that. And it's now, you know, the book comes from the play, which was in 2015. I wrote a play at the end of 2014 to commemorate the centenary of the genocide. And I put it to the very tiny Armenian community here in Adelaide that we could actually stage this play as a commemoration. And they balked at the idea at first. They were a little bit afraid of, you know, what it took, because no one had any idea. But I reminded them I am a drama teacher, because I was still working then, and I have written plays and I know what I'm doing. So I have an idea for a play, and I guarantee you I'll write a script by the end of the year, and then we will rehearse it and so on. And long story short, we did. And so the play went on in 2015, and by that stage, the committee had gained the interest of Hamas Kai Chant in Sydney, and some money, towards production costs was forthcoming, and that helped us out with the theatre hire and that sort of thing. So we had a little season in leading up to April 24, which was a Friday night in 2015, and we finished on the Saturday. And it was very well received. A whole lot of people came who knew nothing about the Armenian genocide and were profoundly impressed. Some people were quite moved. And we had a very successful opening night, and some of our Sydney people came, and they were delighted. And long story short, again, they invited us to Sydney, and we performed it there. And to big acclaim, it went really well. We had Gladys Berejiklian, no less, in the audience, although she wasn't the premier then, but, you know, all the kind of Armenian bigwigs in Sydney were. And when the show was all over and we were back in Adelaide, Lilith and I looked at each other and we said, this isn't over. There's more. There's more to this. Unfinished business. You know, Armenia is an analogy for every unimportant figure brushed aside by a bigger and more powerful entity, whose decisions are usually like transactional. There has to be something in the bigger entity to help the smaller entity, or they're not going to be bothering. And so Armenia's problem in part is the fact that it's small, doesn't have influence, and doesn't have any kind of bargaining power. So, that bothered me a lot. And the notion of humanitarianism in an increasingly transactional world, you know, I'm not religious at all, but, you know, I have, I'm a bit of a lapsed Anglican, went to church when I was a kid because I sort of had to, but I learned a bit about the Gospels, and Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But these days, the political climate is more like do unto others as they would do unto you, you know, payback, revenge narrative, whether it's sport, politics, or human relationships, and nowhere more apparent than in the current political climate. no more, were more apparent than in the black and white kind of sporting narratives of the football codes. And there's a whole lot less of the paying it forward, looking out for somebody, helping them with no thought of reward. And all of these factors kind of motivated me to thinking, I want to write this book. I thought about writing it as a book, and the idea just became more and more irresistible. So I began while I was still teaching and worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And then retired from teaching, and I still wasn't done. I tried submitting it to traditional publishers probably too soon. Didn't get any luck. But, you know, again, cutting to the chase, I finally polished it to the point where I think it is, you know, really, it's a polished work now. And I decided to self-publish, and I decided to wear the cost and the risk and just do it. And the people in Sydney were more than delighted that I had done it and made the effort to go there. And Lilith and I feel very happy that we have. And, you know, the journey has just started. So, you know, there's quite a lot of adventure to come.
So the novel is based on your play, Journey to Fate?
Yes, Journey of Faith, yeah. Yeah, there's a Journey of Faith, the play, had two older characters, an older Armenian woman and an older Turkish man. And they have a confrontation in front of the war memorial on North Terrace in Adelaide. And so the novel begins kind of more or less where the play began. And then the latter part of where the play went, you know, the latter part of the interaction between the two, that's right near the end of the novel. And, of course, the interleaving nearly 300 pages are, of course, Anush's story, Anush being the protagonist, the central character, the eponymous angel of Aleppo. And, so it's there's a lot of fleshing out of the initial ideas and a lot more research and a lot more shaping and reshaping the narrative. But, you know, in the end, I'm very happy with it as a representation of the play's original idea. And on the cover, you've got the Armenian the forget-me-nots, you know. It's the shape of the memorial at Tita Nakhabert, and it gives me my inspiration. I've been there twice, Tita Nakhabert, and the forget-me-not flower is the most potent symbol of the genocide. And so that is the central image on the cover, and I think it should speak to all Armenians. And people who aren't Armenian, it will be intrigued by it, I think. And so I'm hoping that, you know, people aren't going to be disappointed about no image of the beautiful young woman on the cover, because no artist is going to capture how Anush must look, how she looks in my mind. Every reader gets to work out what Anush looks like for themselves, which is the beauty of the printed word. And it is a memorable tale, and it becomes more memorable with all the research that I did, because I planted real-life characters in there, and like Henry Morgenthau, Armin T. Wegner, the German humanitarian. So you've got the consul to the U.S. consul to the Ottoman Empire gets to speak in his voice, and so does the great German humanitarian who documented so much of the genocide and for whom, you know, we are indebted for the bulk of the decent photographs that remain of the genocide. There's them, and there's also the unsung but very significant figure of Reverend James Creswell from Adelaide, who spearheaded the post-war Armenian relief effort that came out of Australia, and it was a big effort. Now, a lot of money raised, a lot of, you know, clothes, blankets, all sorts of things, primarily for orphans, and the establishment of an orphanage in Antelias in Beirut, which Creswell himself visited in 1923. So I've got some real-life characters populating the pages, and the important ones get to sort of speak in their own narrative voice. I've got Anush narrating in first person the chapters. This is a decision I arrived at after about 16 drafts. So Anush tells you like she's sitting down telling you the story at the kitchen table. And every other chapter is a shorter chapter in the voice of a different character, one of the significant characters who interacts with Anush. The only exception is the Morgenthau, who does make an oblique reference to the Angel of Aleppo. But, the novel from the play, it has subsumed my life to a fair degree, in a way that is very good. I'm very happy with.
So you have incorporated Australian connection to the Armenian genocide in your novel?
Absolutely. What happens when you come to read the novel, it begins, as I said, in Adelaide. So the prologue, several pages, is, you know, for those who saw the play, they'll recognise the characters in the scene. But then it cuts back to Anush at 16 before the Empire's bully boys arrive at her particular village. And then it goes, obviously, from there, the inciting incident for Anush, you know, like the big change in her life. And then it goes forward to what happens to her over the next few years. And a little later on, well, actually a lot later on, Anush finishes in Australia, so there's not too many spoilers just to tell you that much. But one of the characters who speaks in his own voice is the Reverend James Creswell. And so the Reverend Creswell gets to tell you a little bit about the Armenian Genocide from his point of view and what they learnt and what happened. And so the reader, if they don't know anything about the Armenian Genocide at all, will gain a lot of insight on what happened to Armenians. And then they'll also notice that there was quite an Australian connection, which after the first Anzac Day, it had almost equal billing because it was widespread knowledge that the Ottoman Empire were murdering Armenians. And even in 1916, the news had reached Australia, well, mainly via London and what was coming out of London and the US. But people knew about it. And they knew a lot more about it when they were raising money, sort of in the latter stages of the war. A lot of Australian soldiers came home and telling stories about what they'd seen in the Middle East. And there were people like Stanley Savage, who were commando types in Dunster Force at the end of World War One, who went way behind enemy lines on a mission into Persia, and they ended up shepherding a whole lot of refugees, Armenian refugees, sort of past Turkish guns and saving lots of lives. I haven't got any reference to Dunster Force in the story, but that's something I'm thinking about for the future. All these guys who knew about what had happened, there was a noted aviator, Thomas White. He was a pioneering type aviator. He flew planes. He was, I think he was from Melbourne originally. He was flying planes and bombing Turkish positions, like literally dropping bombs out of an open biplane. He was forced down and he was taken prisoner, and he had 3 years as a prisoner in Anatolia. And he wasn't having the Turks as noble foes, that narrative. He was highly critical of anyone who started talking about the Turks as noble foes, because he witnessed the Armenian genocide. He saw them being kicked out of villages, whipped and clubbed. You know, he saw men being marched off, men being shot and hung. And this man wrote a book called Guests of the Unspeakable. And, you know, this is all in the knowledge bank of Australians. Thomas White ended up marrying the daughter of the second Prime Minister of Australia, Alfred Deakin, and he became a parliamentarian himself and a significant public figure. There was no sort of mystery. There was nothing was hidden. There was an Armenian genocide, and Australians knew all about it. And they were aware that the you know, jihadists, the henchmen of Talat Pasha murdered all the important Armenians the day before and during the initial landing at Anzac. No Australians are aware of that as a rule, you know, only sort of a small number of people seem to know that. And no one has made that connection that the Anzacs basically unwittingly provided a bit of a smokescreen for those guys to do their dirty work. That is noted at some point in the novel, and along with a number of the other things I've just sort of alluded to.
You just mentioned before that you self-published your book. I know it's not easy to publish a book and distribute it. What were the hurdles you had to overcome?
Well, the first hurdle is fear, because you just don't know what you're doing. For any aspiring indie author, that's what I am, I'm an indie author, as in independent, any aspiring indie author, I recommend you firstly go to the Alliance of Independent Authors Facebook page and have a look, and then join the association, because you can get a lot of advice and a lot of help from people there, and it's like a community of people who do the same thing. It is possible to write your book and upload it to Amazon for free. It is quite possible to do that. I don't recommend you do it that way, though, because I just went into having been rejected by more publishers than Jo Rowling was rejected by before she managed to get Harry Potter published, I'm used to the silence from the publishing houses, and they can be pickier and pickier and pickier, and they are. They tend to latch onto the absolute cream of the crop from the creative writing courses in universities, and the occasional other person or celebrity, you know, who writes a book. Those are the people that the established publishing houses are most interested in, and they latch onto them, and almost everyone else is not going to get a look in. So you have to figure out how you're going to do it. So I decided I would invest a bit of money. I just thought, well, I've worked on this novel enough. I have overcome my fear of having to spend money without guarantee of, you know, recompense. So I engaged a person I engaged my editor / marketing guru / production consultant, a lady called Beth Kalman Werner in Philadelphia. She lives in Philadelphia in the US. And I've had Zoom conferences with her. And I also engaged a cover designer to create this magnificent cover that I have on the book. And so I spent some money. And then what I'm doing with Beth especially is I'm tapping into the expertise of someone who knows how to market a book, who can edit the book, and has a team of people who are expert in uploading books to the internet. And so, you know, with all of that in mind, I'm now live on Amazon. A lot of independent authors try and do it themselves, you see, and then they can't figure out all the tech stuff, and they can, but it's very hard. So unless you're very cluey with computer programs, I recommend, you know, investing a bit of money in professionals who can help you. And the other thing is, you must get someone to edit your book. You have to. You can have beta readers who can help you out, but you've got to have a proper copy edit and, you know, a proper proof edit, because the proof edit's going to pick up the punctuation bloopers and spelling and all of that. And the copy editor is going to, you know, like, hopefully pick up any real issues with plot line or inconsistencies and stuff like that. And you may think you've written a masterpiece, and there may be some great ideas in it, but, you know, as a whole, it's all over the shop, and, you know, there are holes in the plot. There are problems with the you know, the nature of the narrative development and all sorts of other things that you can't see because you're too closely invested in the work. So the first thing you overcome is fear. The second thing you overcome is your reluctance to spend money. And when you've overcome those two things, mm-hmm. it's not so hard anymore.
John, where your book is available for purchase?
Well, it's on Amazon. You can actually go to my website, johncox.com, and I'll spell it, johncocks.com. That's the other thing I did. I got a web page developer to give me, you know, a decent WordPress site. I already had one, which I'd kind of put together myself, but it was terrible. And the website I have now, the domain, I bought the domain, johncox.com. The website I have now is clean, very accessible. You can just Google it and boom, up it comes. And you can go to the books thing, click on it, and the books tab at the top and click on it. There is a picture of the cover and a button to click on, which will take you straight through to Amazon. So it's available as an ebook or as a paperback. At the moment, I'm in the throes of doing live, you know, book launches, as you know, and so I have a whole bunch of physical copies of the book, and I'm selling them, you know, like face-to-face selling at launches. I may get to the point where I print more to, you know, sell directly to people in Australia. That is, I'm undecided on that. But I can be contacted directly through my website. You know, people can actually just email me and to seek out the best way for them to buy the book. A few people have already done that. But, you know, failing all of that, you can just jump on there. And if you've got a Kindle reader, you can just, you know, go to Amazon, pay the money, download, and you'll be reading it in half an hour. So such is the magic of technology. You know what? I've never picked up a Kindle reader. I have never held one in my hand. You know, I'm old school. I like a real book. But a lot of people are quite happy to have 10,000 books on their device. And, you know, if that's how they want to read it, that's fine by me too. It's great. Mm-hmm. Good. It's just get out there and read my book. That's what I want.
Yeah, good idea. John, thank you for the interview. Hopefully we'll see you also in Melbourne for the launch of your book.
No worries. And I really hope that we can make that happen. And can I also just ask readers, people who might have read it already or are reading it or are planning to read it, can you please go on Goodreads or Amazon or anywhere else where you can do this, and write your review, your honest thoughts on my novel. I would most appreciate that. The more people who write reviews, the better it is for to have people who, especially those who don't know anything about the Armenian Genocide, to understand what the book's about and you know, how it tells a story that must be told, and it educates. There is an afterword at the back which puts in perspective why Australia does not appear, has not acknowledged the Armenian Genocide like the Americans have, like President Biden has. And it is to do with the epic narrative about the Anzacs, and it's to do with the special relationship with Turkey and how basically the Turks sold us their lies, pretty much their lies about the Armenian Genocide. The official position being that they were never, there was no genocide, nothing happened. It was just some Armenians rising. It was, you know, it was wartime stuff. These things happen, but no, we didn't mass murder anyone. It's all a mistake. Nothing happened. Nothing to see here. And we bought into that when we accepted the words from Mustafa Kemal to the Anzac mothers. They are words on a wall on Anzac Parade, opposite our war memorial. They're on a wall at the memorial in New Zealand, and they're on the wall at Anzac Cove. And the Anzac Cove was renamed that from its original title or name of Ali Banu in exchange for Mustafa Kemal being acknowledged in Australia. And it kind of means that an enemy general is being honoured at our war memorial, and the enemy general's lies about there was no Armenian genocide becomes our position. We are complicit in it. And no Conservative Prime Minister is likely to acknowledge the Armenian genocide because he will have the Conservatives howling for his head, which is fairly predictable because, of course, Anzac Cove will be cancelled and there will be no more special relationship and a whole lot of people will be very unhappy. And this is an a very bad situation that we have painted ourselves into. We're painted into a corner, and it's going to require, I think, some special diplomacy and some special explanation and leadership from our federal government to extricate ourselves from this ridiculous situation. Here we are, first world democracy, and we are complicit in the lies of a major crime, and we won't do anything about it. And I don't believe it's going to come from current government. I'd be very happy for Scott Morrison to prove me wrong, but I don't think it's coming from our current government.
Things might change if Turkey becomes a real democracy, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah, good luck with that. I mean, yes, who knows? Who knows? It'd be great. I know there are civilized Turks in that nation of 75 million people who would love to see the back of him, but they have been a dictatorship since the word go. It's a one-party country, you know, like there's no opposition to that leadership. And Kemal established the nothing to see here policy from the word go in 1923, and all his successors have maintained it, even though people like Hrant Dink in 2006 got himself murdered for publicly opposing that official viewpoint. So you can see what's happening. And this neo-Ottoman pan-Turkic revenge narrative last year, 27th of September to the 10th of November, in which Erdogan's puppet Aliyev, supported by Erdogan and Syrian mercenaries, assaulted the Independent Republic of Artsakh and dealt Armenia a military defeat. That's all a part of the scenario that Armenia faces in Australia, as you know, with barely ripple on the surface in relation to that. I know SBS reported it a little bit, but and they certainly told the story more or less what happened, but they were not putting it in historical terms. They were just saying Azerbaijan invaded Artsakh. They were supported by some more up-to-date technology from, the Turks barely got a mention. And it appears that Azerbaijanis have defeated the Armenians. They have called a ceasefire and they've taken back a whole lot of territory. And that's about as far as it got, as far as the reports went. Not good enough. Here in this first world democracy, we should be doing a lot more, and we're not. In South Australian Parliament, Artsakh got acknowledged the other day, not long ago. Well, not the other day, but, you know, a month or so ago. I think it's been acknowledged in New South Wales as well. But the federal government is hamstrung by this narrative that we are complicit in, and it's simply not good enough. In my eyes, I'm just not happy with it at all. And I think I'm not alone. I said as much in the Sydney launch, and I didn't get anyone disagreeing with me there. So, if my novel can help in any way in broadening the narrative, the reach of the true narrative, and helping people understand how Australia's complicit in the Turkish genocide denial by accepting the special relationship, then so much the better. the more Australians who know that. There's plenty of fair-minded Australians and plenty of Australians who are a bit over the, Anzacs as Homeric gods sort of narrative that is that we have. I think it's gone a bit too far. You know, the Prime Minister himself refers to the war memorial as, you know, the nation's sacred heart or something like that, he says. And, you know, okay, it's a great memorial. Okay, you know, Australian soldiers have acquitted themselves mostly pretty well in overseas war theatres, but ascribing a religious edge to it is going too far. And I think there are plenty of Australians who would agree with that. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that one day Turkey will get a civilised leader and become an actual democracy. And I'm hoping that we in Australia will get a leader with the courage of his or her conviction to formally acknowledge the Armenian genocide.
John, thank you again for your time and thoughts on the Armenian genocide and the Australian connection.
No worries. Thank you very much, Vahey. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And, have a look at my book and see what you think.
Our guest was John Cox, author of the novel Angel of Aleppo. My sincere thanks to Nora Bastagian for facilitating the interview with John. Հավնե, լայք, բաժանեք, կարծիքդ հայտնել, հետևե SBS հայրենին թիմադեդրի վրա։